Welcome to The World is Watching, a program of news, commentary, and thoughtful opinion about current events here in the U.S. as reported in newspapers, magazines, and journals from throughout the world. Learning what people, governments, and organizations around the world are thinking and saying about events unfolding in America gives us a different perspective for how to interpret and understand the events happening around us. How do other cultures perceive us and what is happening in America? Is it the same or starkly different from our own perspective of ourselves? For this program, we will select news, commentary, and opinion from a selection of established and respected press sources throughout the world. In some countries, journalistic independence and freedom of speech by individuals is more limited than we are accustomed to here in the U.S. When appropriate, we'll make note of these restrictions as a quick reminder to the listener. Now, let's turn our attention to news and commentary from around the world during the past several weeks. Our first article today comes from Hong Kong. It was published in the South China Morning Post. Why Biden is racing to build a Trump-proof U.S. alliance system. The trilateral summit last Thursday between the United States, Japan, and the Philippines had the semblance of a Trump-proof exercise. Incumbent administrations in Washington, Tokyo, and Manila needed to secure one pillar of the anti-China system of alliances that U.S. President Joe Biden has painstakingly rebuilt and reinforced after 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency, marked by tensions and disagreements with U.S. allies and partners in the Western Pacific. Polls give Trump a fair chance of winning the November presidential election, and alarm bells cannot but ring in Tokyo, Seoul, Taipei, Manila, and Canberra. Indeed, Trump's idiosyncratic distrust of collective security could weaken the web of military connections the Biden team has devised to counter China's growing geopolitical assertiveness. Deepening security relations may minimize the risk of a turnaround by a new Trump administration. If the geostrategic bonds between the U.S. and its friends are inextricably linked to America's national interest, it will be more difficult for Trump to disrupt them. Biden's efforts to cement alliances and partnerships in the Indo-Pacific region have come at a time when appetite for bilateral, multilateral, and unilateral cooperation against China's advancements is growing. Tokyo and Washington are taking steps to create a joint military command to deter China. And, despite Canberra's denial, some sort of expansion of the AUKUS security alliance between the U.S., Britain, and Australia seems to be in the cards, as underlined by Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. In a recent interview, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the Atlantic Alliance had to cooperate with other actors beyond its geography to counter a budding alliance of authoritarian powers formed by China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. In this respect, he explicitly cited Japan and South Korea as potential partners in NATO's expanded focus. Even New Zealand, which is traditionally careful not to antagonize China despite being part of the Western camp, is playing the game. Foreign Minister Winston Peters said on April 5 that his country would work with NATO, quote, to contribute to collective security, close quote, and would finalize a partnership deal with the alliance in the coming months. That said, Trump's possible return to power is actually agitating Biden's Indo-Pacific interlocutors who are rushing to calm domestic opinion. Kishida has emphasized that his country's alliance with the United States would remain unbroken even if American voters elect a new president. The Philippines says as much, as does South Korea. For its part, the leadership in Taiwan availed itself of opportunities thrown up by Trump's presidency, whether it was the phone call between the Taiwanese president Tsai Ing-wen and Trump after his election in 2016, or Washington's enhanced military support for the island, including arms sales and routine patrols of the Taiwan Straits during his mandate. The problem for U.S. allies and partners in the vast region is that Trump's backing in the confrontation with China cannot be taken for granted. He recently caused concern when he said he would not defend NATO allies against Russia if they did not meet their financial obligations. If he were to abandon Ukraine to its destiny in the conflict with Russia, as suggested by Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban after his meeting with the former U.S. president in March, U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific would not be counting on a new Trump administration to defend them. To assuage concerns, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said on April 9 that there would be more joint naval patrols by the U.S., Australia, Japan, and the Philippines amid Manila's territorial dispute with Beijing. According to the joint statement, after the three-way talks between Biden, Kishida, and Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the three countries' coast guards, quote, plan to conduct an at-sea trilateral exercise and other maritime activities in the Indo-Pacific, close quote, within the next year. A military presence in the Western Pacific is a cornerstone of Washington's China containment strategy. However, Trump has never loved joint allied exercises and patrols. In 2019, he said a U.S.-South Korea combined military drill was unnecessary and a waste of money. To maintain Biden's alliance architecture in the Western Pacific, Trump would have to find it attractive. This means Japan must deliver on its commitment to rearmament, which seems to put it in a bind, given that the Japanese government is planning tax increases to cover the rising military outlays. South Korea might have to pay a larger share of the cost of maintaining U.S. troops on its soil, and Taiwan could be asked to invest more in the U.S. chip industry in return for military assistance. The AUKUS deal is also likely to be in the firing line. Trump may expect more funds from Australia for the U.S. shipyards building Virginia-class attack submarines. Under the AUKUS partnership, Canberra should be able to buy between 3 and 5 of these subs from the early 2030s. However, the Biden administration is scaling down submarine production amid long-standing backlogs at U.S. shipyards and funding problems, with U.S. Navy Secretary Carlos Del Toro working to attract Asian investment to U.S. shipbuilding facilities. Ultimately, Trump doesn't just believe that U.S. military might alone, rather than collective security, is enough to deter a Chinese armed adventure. He is also persuaded that he himself is the strongest deterrent to China. His unpredictability is a political factor U.S. allies and partners will have to deal with again should he win re-election. Our next article comes from France, published in the newspaper Le Monde, or The World. The Washington can no longer dither in support for Ukraine. Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, lies some 40 kilometers from the Russian border, and for weeks has been living through the hell of daily bombings. Nearly 2 million people lived there before the invasion on February the 24th of 2022. A few hundred thousand left, and while some have returned, life is becoming increasingly difficult. Russian missiles and drones are systematically destroying the energy infrastructure of the city, which could well find itself without heating by fall. Despite Ukraine's connection to the European electricity grid, Power cuts are increasing as thermal power plants across the country come under attack. In 2022, Kharkiv, where a large part of the population is Russian-speaking, valiantly resisted an attempt by Russian forces to take the city, forcing the occupiers to withdraw. Today, Russia seems to have opted for a different tactic, to make the city unlivable in order to force its inhabitants to abandon it, even if this means destroying it. Ukraine is now facing a crucial and eminently dangerous phase in its war with Russia. Outnumbered by the enemy, its soldiers are exhausted and anxiously awaiting relief, which is slow in coming. They are also anxiously awaiting weapons and munitions, which the West is having trouble delivering in the quantities required. The Russian army, on the other hand, can count on a far greater number of men due to the size of its population and benefits from the establishment of a war economy that keeps arms factories running at full speed. The Russian economy, far from being impoverished by Western sanctions, is holding up thanks to the circumvention of sanctions by a number of countries, including China. An urgent need for military equipment. According to the Institute for the Study of War, an American research center, Russian forces have managed to gain 300 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory since January. The intensification of the civilian infrastructure bombing campaign highlights a serious shortcoming for Ukraine: insufficient air defense assets in the face of Russian firepower. At this rate, the goal of a Ukrainian victory, which Western countries claim to support, risks becoming an illusion. General Christopher Cavoli, head of the U.S. Army's European Command, spoke the truth on Wednesday, April the 10th, before the House Armed Services Committee. Ukraine can't go it alone. Russia continues to pose an existential threat. The Russian aggressor has lost some 2,000 tanks and 315,000 men killed or wounded, but is rebuilding its forces at an unexpected speed. The Russian army is now 15% larger than at the start of the war, and it's getting help from China, Iran, and North Korea. Ukraine urgently needs military reinforcements to avoid collapse. The Europeans are trying to pool their resources, but on the other side of the Atlantic, in Congress, Trump-supporting Republicans continue to dither over the procedural games likely to bring to a vote the $60 billion aid package promised by the Biden administration and stalled for 6 months. Putting a quick end to these sordid games which dishonor American democracy while playing into Moscow's hands is vital for Ukraine.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead.
This next article comes from Ireland. It was published in the Irish Times. Congress held hostage. For 6 months, U.S. Congress Republicans have stalled a vital $60 billion aid package for Ukraine, now forced to ration its depleted artillery stocks. Russian troops now outfire Ukrainian forces by a 5-to-1 ratio, a top U.S. commander told a congressional hearing last week, warning that Ukraine could lose the war if the U.S. did not send more ammunition and fast. He was not crying wolf. Western allies and Kyiv are entreating the U.S. to free the cash, and a majority of Americans, 58%, according to a recent poll, favor sending more economic aid and weapons to Ukraine. In Congress, the vast majority of Democrats and most Republicans back the package, which could well sail through on a bipartisan vote when it is put to a vote. Yet such is the power of Speaker of the House Mike Johnson that he has been able to avoid putting it to a vote for fear of being toppled by a clique of Trumpite right-wingers who oppose more funding for Ukraine. Some insist that the war is unwinnable and that the U.S. should simply force Ukraine to sue for peace. Trump says it should cede the Donbass and Crimea in exchange for a ceasefire and promises he would seek to impose such an outcome as president. Others claim the U.S. cannot afford to fund Ukraine or are explicit supporters of Putin and his war aims, regarding Russia as a friend. In order to sweeten the bitter pill for those far-right supporters who put him in place, Johnson, who promises that a vote will be allowed shortly, is cynically tagging onto it a collection of unrelated measures from Republican wish lists, like unfreezing the administration's pause on liquefied natural gas exports. Whether that will placate the far right is not clear. That Ukraine's beleaguered people should be held hostage to the Republicans' internecine war and its whims of isolationism is a sorry commentary on the state of American politics, and it risks encouraging more Russian military aggression if Moscow feels that the West's resolve is weakening.
You are listening to The World is Watching, a production of the Audio Journal.
This next article comes from Israel, published in the Jerusalem Post. Israel must not write off the Democratic Party, but rather show it the truth. As America changes, so does its attitudes about Israel, especially a not insignificant part of the U.S. population that views the world through a social justice prism. The Democratic Party hates Israel, President Donald Trump thundered last month in an interview with his former aide, Sebastian Gorka. On Tuesday, he said President Joe Biden has abandoned Israel, and any Jewish person that votes for a Democrat or votes for Biden should have their head examined. Trump is wrong. The Democratic Party does not hate Israel, and Biden has not abandoned the Jewish state. Stalwart Democratic Israeli supporters, such as Senators John Fetterman from Pennsylvania and Jackie Rosen from Nevada, as well as congressmen like New York's Richie Torres, New Jersey's Josh Gottheimer, and Illinois' Brad Schneider, prove that Trump's first assertion is incorrect. And Biden's statement on Thursday that his commitment to Israel's security against threats from Iran and its proxies is ironclad disproves Trump's assertion about the incumbent president's abandonment of Israel. Trump supporters may argue these are just words, but the president's dispatch of an Air Force carrier strike force to the eastern Mediterranean shortly after October the 7th to deter Iran from attacking Israel shows he has a track record backing up those words. Yet, we must admit, there are worrying signs within the party that its longtime commitment to Israel is waning. A sign of this is a letter signed by 56 Democratic representatives, almost a quarter of the 213 House Democrats, calling on Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken to reconsider arms transfers to Israel at the very time that the country is fighting a terrorist organization bent on its destruction. That this letter was signed not only by the anti-Israeli squad and other assorted progressive lawmakers, but also by pro-Israel stalwarts like former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, is another sign. Yet another sign is that Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren faced little blowback from within the party when she said international courts may rule that Israel is committing genocide and repeated the lie that the Jewish state is intentionally starving Palestinians. If before the current war, it was comfortable to dismiss the anti-Israel voices inside the party from Congress people like Bernie Sanders, Ilhan Omar, and Rashid Tlaib as the inconsequential murmurings of a definite minority, these sentiments have started to seep into the party's mainstream since the war. This is a worrisome trend. While some of the rhetoric against Israel is a result of the war, this is a process that started long before the war and will continue regardless of how the war turns out. The growing partisan debate inside America has as much to do with changing dynamics and demographics inside the U.S. as it does with Israeli policies. America is considerably less religious, older, and more ethnically diverse than it was a generation ago. The country is polarized, with race and gender dominating much of the national conversation and social media turning that conversation toxic. As America changes, so too will its attitudes towards Israel. Among a not insignificant part of the U.S. population, there is now a tendency to view the world through a social justice prism, judging what is right and wrong based on who is strong and who is weak, who is the perceived oppressor and who is the perceived oppressed. Those tendencies are far more prevalent inside the Democratic Party than the Republican one, explaining why support for Israel among Republicans, both politicians and the public, is so much higher than it is among Democrats. Over the last decade, polls have shown a steady drop in sympathy for Israel among Democrats, something that has filtered upward and translated into less sympathy for Israel by Democratic politicians. Nonetheless, Israel must not write off the Democrats as a party that, as Trump erroneously charges, hates Israel. First of all, it is patently false, and secondly, because bipartisan support for the Jewish state in Washington is one of Israel's key strategic assets. Instead of dismissing the Democratic Party as one that has turned its back on Israel, Jerusalem should concentrate its energies on bringing its truth to those significant segments of the party not taken in by the far-left slogans, who understand that supporting Israel is not only the morally right thing to do, but also what is in America's best interests. You're listening to The World is Watching, a production of the Audio Journal. In this next article, we shift focus to the domestic political election news. This from Australia, published in the Australian Broadcasting Corporation News. Donald Trump's anger at a Republican ally highlights his fear of women's voting power ahead of the U.S. election. Donald Trump may have locked up the Republican nomination with stunning speed, but he is keenly aware of a major hurdle that could stand between him and the White House: women. Many Americans who support access to abortion are motivated, angry, and ready to punish Republicans, including Trump, at the ballot box on Election Day. Since the constitutional right to an abortion was overturned by a conservative-leaning Supreme Court nearly 2 years ago, abortion bans have come down in more than 20 states. On Tuesday, an Arizona court revived legislation from 1864 that outlaws abortion in almost all cases. Next month, a ban on abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy takes effect in Florida. But voters keep pushing back. Late last year, the state of Ohio, which Trump won twice, voted overwhelmingly to enshrine abortion rights in its constitution. The result continued a winning streak for abortion rights campaigners, who'd had victories in all six states that previously voted on them. The issue also boosted Democrats in the 2022 midterms and state races again last year. So Trump is now trying to prevent abortion from being a defining issue again when he goes up for election in November. Unlikely help from hardliners. Democrats like to go up against abortion hardliners at the ballot box. They've even been known to help anti-abortion candidates win Republican primaries because they believe those candidates are easier for Democrats to beat. Take the example of the car salesman turned blockchain executive Bernie Moreno, the Trump-endorsed candidate in last month's Republican Senate primary in Ohio. A Democratic political action committee spent millions of dollars on TV ads telling Ohioans Donald Trump needs Bernie Moreno. The ad described Moreno as a MAGA extremist who embraced Donald Trump just like he embraced his policies to ban abortion nationwide. It was ostensibly an attack ad, but Democrats knew painting Moreno as the Trumpist choice would help him win over Republican voters. Sure enough, those voters chose him to be the party's Senate candidate. That's what Democrats wanted because they believe Moreno's hardline conservative views, chiefly on abortion, will make him an easier opponent at the November poll. Trump knows Democrats plan to target him in a similar way. Seeking to deal with the issue once and for all, he this week put out a video outlining his stance on abortion. But the subsequent fallout, which includes an online fight with one of his friends, shows that won't be easy. Be smart, Republicans. After hinting for weeks he'd support a national ban on abortion, Trump backed away from that on Monday. In a 4-minute video, typically laden with mistruths, including the false claim Democrats support execution after birth, he declared abortion laws should be left up to individual states. Whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state, Trump said. He didn't hide the fact that, in taking that position, he was thinking about how to maximize his chances of winning back the White House. A few hours after his video dropped, he posted, "We cannot let our country suffer any further damage by losing elections on an issue that should always have been decided by the states." He also declared, "By allowing the states to make their decision, we have taken the abortion issue largely out of play." But his posts also revealed his frustration with those on his own side of politics who were still pushing for a national ban. "Be smart, Republicans," he warned. While Trump's announcement was meant to win the trust of American women and their allies, it quickly turned into an argument between two men. He took particular aim at Lindsey Graham, a Republican senator who once described Trump as a jackass, but is now such an ally, he's appeared on stage with him at campaign rallies and speeches. Graham tweeted that he respectfully disagreed with Trump's abortion policy and that he'd keep advocating for a national ban on abortion at 15 weeks, with exceptions for rape, incest, and saving a mother's life. Trump responded by saying Graham is doing a great disservice to the Republican Party and to our country. Many good Republicans lost elections because of this issue, and people like Lindsey Graham that are unrelenting are handing Democrats their dream of the House, Senate, and perhaps even the presidency, Trump posted. A motivating issue. President Joe Biden and his campaign are determined not to let Trump take abortion out of play. Trump appointed three of the Supreme Court justices that overturned Roe v. Wade, the legal ruling that made abortion access a constitutional right, and later claimed credit for the court's decision. Democrats are releasing their own videos as they take every opportunity to remind voters that Trump's ultimately responsible for the bans that are spreading across the country. A TV ad released on Monday features a Texas woman who says she almost died when she was denied medical care after a miscarriage because of the state's abortion ban. "Donald Trump did this," the official Biden campaign ad says. Biden has pledged to restore abortion access if he's reelected with enough support in Congress. And he points out to what Trump didn't mention in his video. A conservative Congress could pass a law to bring in a national ban, and Trump hasn't said he would veto it. A Trump administration could also restrict the abortion pills that doctors now commonly ship to women in states that ban the procedure. There are many reasons the issue is likely to remain front of mind for voters in November. Florida, New York, and Maryland will put questions to voters about abortion on Election Day, and there are campaigns for similar referendum elsewhere, including key swing states like Arizona and Nevada. Meanwhile, in a recent YouGov-CBS poll, 51% of respondents said abortion would be a major factor in their vote for president. Only 17% said it wouldn't be a factor at all. And a Kaiser Family Foundation poll shows it remains a particularly motivating issue for female voters, especially Black women, Democratic women, and women in states with abortion bans. 1 in 6 women of a reproductive age said it was the most important issue for them this election. All this makes it easy to see why Trump wants Republicans to pipe down on the issue. But even if they do, Biden and the Democrats are likely to keep talking about it nonstop. Donald Trump and all those responsible for overturning Roe don't have a clue about the power of women in America, Biden said after Trump's video release, but they are about to find out. As the two male presidential contenders fight over the future of abortion, one message appears to be cutting through with the women they are hoping to win over. Women would have only as much reproductive freedom as Donald Trump and his allies would allow them, Ruth Marcus, an associate editor and columnist for the Washington Post, wrote. And we know how little that is.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead.
This next article continues on the topic of the domestic politics and election, and in particular the abortion issue, this time from Germany, published in the newspaper Die Tageszeitung, or Daily News. As Arizona marches 160 years backward, Arizona's Supreme Court has upheld an 1864 law banning abortion. That's making Republicans nervous about their election campaign. 7 months before the presidential election, Republicans were hit with a court ruling in Arizona that is actually entirely in their interest ideologically. On Tuesday, the state Supreme Court reinstated an 1864 law making performance of an abortion punishable by imprisonment, except in cases where the mother's life is in danger. The decision is based on the elimination of a woman's federal right to seek an abortion, which was guaranteed from 1973 until 2022 by the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. Although strict anti-abortion laws have been in effect since 2022 in some conservative states, abortion was still possible in Arizona until now. A petition in favor of enshrining abortion rights in the state constitution has collected enough signatures to appear on the November ballot. The conservative state of Ohio passed a similar referendum last November. This is making Republicans nervous. Since the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, Democrats can score almost anywhere with the issue of abortion. Even female Republican voters are not happy about having their rights taken away. Arizona is one of 6 swing states that will be determinative in the presidential election. In 2020, Joe Biden won that state by merely 11,000 votes. Republicans there don't need an issue that will mobilize the other side. And so now even Carrie Lake, who as an outspoken Trump supporter lost to Democrat Katie Hobbs in the 2022 gubernatorial election, is urgently calling on the Republican-controlled Congress and the Democratic governor to swiftly develop legal regulations that prevent reinstating the law from 1864. Not so long ago, Lake campaigned for exactly that. However, she wants to win a Senate election in November, and Republicans know that will not go well. There is little time left. Arizona's Supreme Court, whose 8 justices were all appointed by Republican governors, also ruled on Tuesday to suspend reinstating the old law for the time being until a county court considers any constitutional challenges.
You are listening to The World is Watching, a production of the Audio Journal.
In this next article, we shift topics again, this time from South Korea. The newspaper is Chosun Ilbo. The fall of the American Ivy League in the name of equality and diversity. I tore open the election materials that were mailed to my house. They were full of words like righteousness, equality, justice, diversity, language that was originally meaningful but is now completely negative. Today, there is an ironic and satirical catchphrase that the younger generation is sharing on social media. Entrance exams are like Chokuk, loans are like Yakmun Siok, and gifts are like Gong Young Moon. There are quite a few conservatives who have crossed over into illegality and convenience, but the reason that people are especially directing their criticism at these people is because of their hypocrisy and double standards. It's because these are people and a political party that are shouting this language louder than anyone else. At first, this was promising, but now politically correct language is a target of ridicule. Recent news about the Ivy League schools in the United States Ivy League, reported by the UK publication The Economist, is interesting. Yale and Dartmouth universities have made standardized tests like the SAT mandatory again for applications starting this year. For us, this means that in addition to your personal essays or biographies, we will look at your college SAT scores. Meanwhile, people are worried about the declining quality of the elite American universities. Our readers might be surprised that they haven't even considered grades until now, but prestigious U.S. universities continue to pay attention during the COVID-19 pandemic. This is because the political correctness craze led people to criticize a system where applicants are admitted unconditionally based on diversity, despite the fact they don't meet academic requirements. Finally, last year, the U.S. Supreme Court held that affirmative action, whereby preference is given to minorities in the admission process, was unconstitutional, and Yale and Dartmouth were the first to raise the flag. It has been reported frequently that the academic quality of prestigious U.S. universities, which have put diversity ahead of ability, is not the same as it was, but recent statistics specifically highlight this concern. First of all, there is a sharp decline in the world's university rankings. Every year, the UK's Times recommends universities with the top performance in their fields to more than 30,000 scholars, and the US has dropped in place, while China has climbed over the past 10 years. Starting with Harvard University's quality rating falling from 6% to 4.5%, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Stanford University, University of California, Berkeley, Princeton University, Yale University, and Caltech all dropped in ranking. China's Tsinghua University's rating almost tripled from half of 1% to 1.5%, while Beijing University, Shanghai Transportation University, and Fudan University also rose in rankings. There are now more authors in the top 5% of most cited scientific research papers in China than in the United States. There is no one reason for the declining quality of American universities, but there are many overlapping reasons. U.S. universities are good at nurturing students who respect political correctness, but have shown less interest in rational debate based on freedom of expression or in improving the quality of academic studies. There is another statistic that stands out in this area. According to the University of California, Los Angeles, conservatives are disappearing from American academic circles. The number of professors who identified as politically left-wing increased from 40% in 1990 to 60% in 2017. Only 23% described themselves as moderate, and only 17% identified as right-wing. The situation in the Ivy League schools is more severe. Last year, Harvard student newspaper, the Harvard Crimson, ran an opinion poll among professors in which fewer than 3% identified as conservative and as many as 75% identified as liberal. Which political parties did the American people support during that same time period? We already know that American reality, as it was summed up by Donald Trump's election and the possibility he will be reelected. A student goes to college to study, not to learn political correctness. An audience goes to the theater for entertainment, not to study. And the public supports politicians who will make their lives better, not those who are hypocritical and have double standards. If you forget your true spirit, you lose trust. The important thing is not to have empty reasons, but to have meaning. You're listening to The World is Watching, a production of The Audio Journal. Our next article is a shift back to domestic politics, this time from Canada, published in Le Journal de Montréal. Vladimir Putin conquered Republicans before Ukraine. Donald Trump's arrival on the political scene was a veritable gift for the Russian president. Vladimir Putin has never missed an opportunity to sow discord with his American rival, but one could say that the last 8 years have yielded dividends that exceed investments. After interfering in the 2016 and 2020 elections, Russian hackers are at it again in 2024 and can now rely on elected Republicans to spread disinformation. Hackers are getting better. Already highly effective in promoting Bernie Sanders' candidacy in 2016 to the chagrin of Hillary Clinton, Russian hackers later benefited from Trump's direct or indirect complicity. Trump openly solicited them during a speech before he took Putin's word over information obtained by American intelligence agencies. Those hackers are again hard at work, and not just in the U.S. In their attempts to influence the outcome of the war in Ukraine, they are also targeting Germany, France, and Poland. More threatening still, the hackers have now artificial intelligence at their disposal to multiply deep fakes, steal confidential data, and relay disinformation on multiple platforms using fake accounts like People Say that are still accessible on X, formerly Twitter. Selling one's soul to Putin. Ronald Reagan, whom Republicans once considered their party's greatest president, must be spinning in his grave if he's reading what a growing number of elected GOP officials are saying. Lately, it is not even Democrats who are denouncing the lies being peddled within the GOP, but influential GOP members who are leading the charge. Michael McCaul, who chairs the House Foreign Affairs Committee, spoke yesterday of a veritable conspiracy virus. Those infected repeat Russian disinformation verbatim, with the complicity of certain media outlets like Fox News or its former host, Tucker Carlson. Former presidential candidate and Utah Senator Mitt Romney had the harshest words, suggesting behavior akin to treason. Perhaps more troubling is that several elected Republicans seem to be acting not just out of sheer opportunism, but because they feel a sincere affinity with what Putin is proposing. These Republicans appear to consider Putin an ally and a leader who embodies a version of conservatism that advocates for an authoritarian style while exacerbating a brand of nationalism that reads like those of Viktor Orban and Trump. What these new collabos do not understand is that Putin only wants to weaken the U.S., that theirs is a one-way relationship, and that they are merely puppets in the hands of a highly talented manipulator. And our final article today comes from Qatar, published in Al Jazeera, How Gaza is Changing U.S. Campuses. For more than 5 months now, students across the United States have been rallying in support of Palestinians as they face genocide at the hands of the Israeli army. It is increasingly clear that more and more young Americans view advocacy for Palestine in the same way as Angela Davis does, as, quote, a moral litmus test for the world, close quote. Mobilization is no easy task. Students supporting Palestinian liberation have been stabbed, shot, run over, and sprayed with chemicals used by the Israeli occupation forces. They have been suspended, arrested, and disciplined. They have had to rely on their own labor and the limited funds they have been able to raise for their protest actions. By contrast, pro-Israel students have well-established donor networks, Campus Hillels, and the ear of mainstream media to amplify their complaints that pro-Palestinian activism is anti-Semitic. College administrations, worried about donor money, have also bent over backwards to please powerful individuals and groups who have denounced pro-Palestinian activism and have not hesitated to discipline students on their behalf. Vastly out-resourced and under-protected, advocates for Palestine have become savvy and creative, building alliances with communities that cut across races, classes, and religions, and employing a broad range of tactics and strategies. Their actions range from long-term plans to spontaneous eruptions and everything in between. Some organizing has already borne some fruit. In the University of California system, there have been some notable successes. At the University of California, Davis, pro-Palestinian campaigning resulted in an historic student government vote on February 15th to heed the boycott investment sanctions call. As a result, the student body will refrain from spending any of its $20 million budget on any company on the BDS list. On the same day, the Graduate Student Association at the University of California, Los Angeles, called for divestment from Israel. On February 20, the UCLA student government voted unanimously to demand that the university divest student fees from apartheid, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. On February 29th, the Associated Students of UC Riverside also passed the resolution to fully divest from companies complicit in Israel's genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. On March the 6th, the Associated Students of UC San Diego also voted in favor of a divestment bill. Elsewhere, results have been mixed. At Stanford University, where I teach, students managed to maintain an around-the-clock sit-in for 120 days, demanding the university denounce Israeli apartheid and genocide, support Palestinian students, identify anti-Palestinian biases in teaching and research, and implement divestment initiatives. When the university abruptly demanded that the sit-in be dismantled, more than 500 students rallied to defend it, with many staying overnight, daring the university to arrest them. While some administrators privately expressed some degree of sympathy, no concrete concessions have been made. So students have continued to demonstrate and disrupt campus life and are mounting a campus-wide divestment campaign. Although the Stanford administration has yet to make any meaningful changes, student organizers are quite aware of their achievements. Said one student, quote, "Obviously, it was a protest at the end of the day, but we also created a space for discourse. And it's ironic because the university has been desperate to create a space like that. It has been desperate to create this kind of conversation. This was admitted to us by various administrators, including the president of the university himself. What the sit-in did was do what the university had been trying to do," close quote, said Farah, a student organizer. She told me in a recent interview for my podcast, Speaking Out of Place. What both long-term campaigns and organic, eruptive takeovers have managed to do is to radically change campus environments. Besides the passionate and highly vocal exchanges between people with different views that we have seen at marches and demonstrations, deliberate and methodical divestment campaigns and protracted sit-ins have sustained conversations, debates, and discussions over months. Each of these actions involves bringing in guest speakers, often prominent Palestinian activists, artists, and poets, that fill in gaps in education that U.S. universities have been happy to leave unfilled. Students are therefore both learning from a broader spectrum of sources and are themselves serving to educate others. In the months since October 7, the entire landscape of the U.S. university has changed with regard to Palestine. Some have started to draw parallels with the anti-war student movement during the Vietnam War era. A report by a UC San Diego student newspaper about a pro-Palestinian rally where more than 2,000 showed up said, quote, "A turnout of this degree is unprecedented, even by the anti-Vietnam War student demonstrations in the 1960s and 70s, close quote. As someone who was a student at the University of California at Berkeley during the Vietnam War and a participant in those demonstrations, as well as in today's rallies for Palestinian liberation, I am struck by some clear similarities. First, in both cases, student protests challenged the mainstream media's depiction of the wars and the official positions of their university's administrations. Protest action has served to educate the public and expose the roles institutions of higher education play in national and global power dynamics. University administrators were confronted with their complicity in the wars and their purposeful obstruction of certain kinds of knowledge and learning and could not hide behind sins of omission. Second, these protests aligned the struggles for Vietnamese liberation and Palestinian liberation with both domestic and international struggles and featured broad multiracial and multi-ethnic coalitions that linked together the local, national, and international. These connections have meant that even those at geographically isolated and similar and smaller institutions do not feel detached or alone, but part of something much bigger. At the same time, I am struck by an important and impressive difference. American college students saw their personal lives as inextricably entangled in the Vietnam War. Many of us lost friends in Vietnam. Some of us hid people avoiding the draft or federal investigation for their work in the movement. There was no lack of solidarity with Vietnamese people, but there was not the same kind of focus on the personal that we see now with regard to the genocide in Gaza and the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. I never saw dozens and dozens of Vietnamese flags flying on campus or other national symbols showcased by students like we see today. With flags, kifayas, and other Palestinian symbols, students and other protesters are embodying Palestine in tremendously moving and powerful ways. Beyond the consequences the genocide in Gaza might have on them personally, American college students are expressing historically unprecedented solidarity, empathy, and care for the people of Palestine, and outrage that the United States has been a facilitator of Israel's historic ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. There is no turning back in terms of campus discourse on Palestine. The specifics of the struggle against genocide and apartheid in Palestine have gained strength and amplitude precisely because the sensibilities that were developed in the U.S. and elsewhere since the Vietnam era regarding racism, police and state violence, and other forms of discrimination and cruelty have become permanent parts of our culture and political memory. No right-wing assaults on critical race theory, diversity, or inclusion will change that, and no silencing of critics of Israel under the charge of anti-Semitism is going to last. If anything, the passion, energy, and commitment of today's young people has rekindled the political activist spirit and established intergenerational alliances as the new norm. While it is hard to predict with certainty whether these movements on university campuses will have an effect on the broader national political landscape, I think it is safe to say this. Each of these actions on campus is not only drawn the attention of the local community, it has also drawn its participation. And the outside community consists not only of individuals, it includes unions, church groups, and other civil society groups to force political change. At this point, over 100 municipalities have called for a ceasefire, and at least 85 members of Congress have done the same. While change is happening, it is happening much too slowly, which is why the next months will see no end to or diminishment of student activism for Palestinian rights. That concludes our program for today. We hope you have enjoyed the readings for The World is Watching and feel you've gained a deeper, richer understanding of events happening in America today. For additional information about any article, please contact the Audio Journal at 508-797-1117 or email us at info@audiojournal.org. This program has been archived and is available to share with others or to listen again on our website, www.audiojournal.org, or by using the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. The World is Watching is a production of the Audio Journal. The information and opinions expressed in the readings are those of the authors and publishers and do not reflect those of the Audio Journal, its staff, or the volunteer readers. We want to hear from you. Give us your feedback, suggestions, or comments on this program or any other program on the Audio Journal. Call the office at 508-797-1117 or send email to info@audiojournal.org. Audio Journal is generously supported by the Worcester Memorial Foundation for the Blind, the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, and the generous contributions from listeners like you. Thank you. Stay tuned to Audio Journal. More great programming is coming your way. Audio Journal, your trusted source for news, information, and entertainment in Central Massachusetts. A proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.